You're listening to Music Tectonics.
Welcome back to Music Tectonics, where we go beneath the surface of music and tech. I'm your host, Dimitri Vitsa. I'm also the founder and CEO of Rock, Paper, Scissors, the PR firm and marketing company that specializes in music innovation. And you know, on the show, we talk about music tech funding, but there's a parallel universe we've never talked about on Music Tectonics. How are labels and other creative companies funded? Our guest today is an artist manager who has seen lots of deals, raised money, worked in music tech. And when we met, I realized while I could learn from him, I could share our conversation with you, the Music Tectonics listeners. After working at English independent record label Ninja Tune, Sammy Forzanetti joined London management company Pictures Management in 2013. Working with electronic artists and producers like Lapalux and Sophie, visual artists like Parisian installation art duo Nanotech. In 2018, Sammy parted ways with Pictures Management and founded creative practice and management company Art Department, working with London lifestyle brand Places Plus Faces, helping them build a global events and festival business in partnership with Metropolis and Live Nation, launching projects with the likes of Boiler Room, Red Bull, SoundCloud, and he manages Grammy-winning Alessandro Buccellati, Canadian-based producer-writer Potter Elvinger, and artist and producer Pale J. Sammy has also become involved in the blockchain technology space, working alongside artist and designer Carl Phenom on a variety of projects with Epic Games and Unreal Engine, and Dee Gones, founder of NFT marketplace Zora, exploring the core elements of blockchain development, building new applications and online experiments. On the product side, Sammy, with his wife Claire, recently helped found startup Baton, which is pioneering a new creative and collaboration ecosystem and has raised $5 million. All of that makes him an interesting person to talk with us about the state of funding labels, artists, and publishers, and the impact it has on the creative people who launch and run labels. Sammy, welcome to Music Tectonics.
Hi, Dimitri. Thanks for having me.
This is a rare chance that we're actually in my Portland office. We usually do these interviews online, so this is cool to have you right here with me.
That's great. When I've done this kind of stuff before on Zoom, it's always had a little bit of a disconnect.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's just dive right in. How are indie labels traditionally funded?
I mean, there's a variety of ways that they're funded, but generally they start at inception either with self-funding or with partners putting in kind of the core funding to launch the label, and then later on through the exploitation of catalog that they own or license, publishing rights sometimes, merchandising. Rarely, but sometimes you do find them being involved in the live side of things, in the live business.
So you're saying they're funded through cash flow?
Yeah, essentially.
When they want to get to the next level, what do they do traditionally?
Traditionally, what you'd find an indie label doing is, I mean, at some point in their journey, they've done some sort of a deal with the distributor. You know, that distributor will be part of a larger label group or larger body, or will be attempting to build a larger label group or body. Generally, what you find is those independent labels getting further into bed, for lack of a better term, with that distributor, or maybe doing a JV with a larger company, or just like going at it solo, which is successful sometimes, but a lot of the time it kind of raises a lot of challenges that a lot of these creatives and business leaders, you know, who started independently aren't particularly prepared for, frankly, which is, you know, managing relationships with stakeholders, managing multiple workers, basically. Managing a larger company.
Right. So if they want to scale, or if somebody is encouraging them towards growth, like you said, they'll do some kind of deal with the distributor, which starts to look a little bit like, not quite a joint venture, does it?
No, not necessarily. I mean, what do you mean?
Is it like advances that have to be recouped, similar to what an artist is doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. Correct.
Or so that might be like the entry level, sort of like, oh, you guys want to push further, why don't we give you this advance, and then we're going to start to take, you know, a cut of your profit moving forward to recoup that and also to make some money there.
Yeah, 100%. And like the differentiator with, say, a JV, when it becomes a JV, is when there's either part purchase of the company involved, or some sort of a larger strategic partnership, larger ownership stakes, closer working relationships, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, fundamentally, part of kind of my thesis around this is the fact that these sort of models haven't really changed in the same, you know, you find this a lot in music where there isn't a large push towards innovation and democratization of access to money. And across the board, you generally find the same kind of deals. And having done a lot of these kind of deals with artists, but also, you know, between artist-led companies, meaning my clients starting companies that they controlled that had rights underneath them and signed other talent, you know, what I was finding was these deals generally take the same shape and form. There isn't a lot of innovation. And really in 2024, what I would say is these deals are just bad. They're not good deals for the creative. You know?
Let's get into that. So we're probably talking about joint ventures there. Mm-hmm. What are the pros and cons of a joint venture for a label who's ready to scale?
I mean, pros, you have access to a greater distribution network. You have access, of course, to capital. You have access to human resources, mentorship, greater access to artists. You know, your sell to artists is bigger, I guess. Bigger is probably a bad word for that, but bigger. Let's say bigger. And on the con, but on the con side, you know, in taking that money, you then have other stakeholders that you have to manage the relationship with, you know, other people in the boardroom, I would say. And that would mean that, like, that fundamentally changes at source the kind of business that you started with, which is just you, a lot of the time in an apartment somewhere, deciding that you love artist X and know exactly what has to happen. Later it becomes like, cool, I want to sign this artist. He or she has no monthly listeners, you know, and your stakeholder being like, I have more experience. That doesn't work. You know,
like, right.
And so, yeah, there's a certain learning curve. Some people, you know, do really well in that scenario and situation, but like a lot of people fall by the wayside.
It reminds me of the innovator's dilemma, where you have one set of business practices and then you're almost going into a different type of business.
Yes,
right?
100%.
Like your original idea, first of all, you're starting with nothing, so you don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
Nobody's making you do anything. So you're starting with, I'm going to go look for some cool music, or I'm part of a scene. I'm going to elevate that scene. I'm going to do deals with artists who I think are part of something that's emerging, and I want to be a part of that world and expand on it. And the creative part is really both selecting those artists and helping them develop their music, their visuals, their career,
their network,
their audience engagement, and their business network as well. Mm-hmm. But with a particular goal in mind that might not be the same as what, quote, the investors, the joint venture folks are doing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, you can look at it in the emergence of the independent label, for example, versus the major label. This is kind of a very known discussion where, like, the major label cares only about money. But that's not a personality problem. That's a scale issue. Because at scale, these companies have to worry about the bottom line, especially in the way that music operates now, with streaming, with a hit-driven culture, with all the various income streams and social media and you know, the scene changing, like, over a summer, essentially. Like, at scale, these companies have to concern themselves with that. Versus a guy in an apartment in Brooklyn who loves punk rock, who also works at a coffee shop, where, you know, it's relatively, he's immediately there. He understands that and sees the potential for that scene to grow globally. There must be other kids like me out there somewhere, but it also costs me $1,000 to put out this record. Versus, like, when you go to a major label, like business, there's 12 people in business affairs and everybody's thinking about, well, Japan, how does this work with that? And we need an extra song and blah, 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 blah. So I think that a lot of the nuance is lost, and there's very few people who can kind of, like, not only find artists and understand what needs to happen and see the potential and the value of very nuanced cultural capital, but understand not only how that works at scale, but who they're going to partner with and how they manage those relationships, because all these people are different. You know, not everybody gets into music to be like, hey, you know, I love techno or whatever. Like, a lot of people get into it to, like, oh, this is a great company and we're bringing music to the masses. That's fundamentally different than, I love this punk rock single.
Interesting. Yeah. You go from someone's specific curatorial and aesthetic view to let's scale this perspective, which changes a lot of the conversation.
Yeah, and I have a lot of these discussions. There's a big lost in translation problem a lot of time, where, like, people who are, for example, from the venture capital side, who know fundraising, who are music fans, learned their place in this industry, which is emerging now, kind of venture capital in music, but only really know one way to talk about it because that's how they've understood it. It doesn't mean they're not music fans. It just knows that they don't know how to communicate with guy in Brooklyn in an apartment releasing punk rock records who's like, fuck the man, you're the man. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, and that's kind of the space I've found myself a lot in recently, you know, democratizing, I guess, access to money and helping translate, because that's been my entire career. I'm a translator, I guess.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good role for a manager, I think. Yeah. Well, I want to get into kind of your vision, but before we do, I'm assuming there's some other contextual things happening in society and music. What's changing in music that has people thinking about a different approach to how you go from indie label in a bedroom to expanding out and actually having a national or international reach that would be bigger than just one guy that works at a coffee shop? What's changing that has you thinking about this different approach?
What's changing is the rise and prominence of independent businesses and independent artists and the want to be independent. Whether people understand exactly what that means and the want to have that are two different things, but that goes on the vision board versus before, like you would want to go and sign at Excel. People are like, no, I want to be independent, like artist X. That's something. The decentralization of the income streams before, you know, you'd sell CDs and now it's streaming and people are still working out the streaming model. It's not great, you know? So people are having to work out how else they can monetize content, you know, TikTok, Instagram. You can even monetize a backstage video now if you do it in a clever way. You know, musicians are becoming more in tune with their fans, more directly in tune with their fans as well. And there's less lead from middlemen, I guess.
To me, that's a music tech story in a way. It's like there's all these new tools and online interactions and digital communities that are basically creating other pathways for artists and creative people to reach their audience on their own. And it's not easy, but it is. I could sort of see why you're saying it the way you're saying it, because that shift has been happening for decades at this point, and we're at a place where it's sort of like, I can do it without this other help. Maybe I'll try something different.
Yeah, and labels, you're seeing also labels really trending in the direction of like changing philosophically how they approach working with artists and working with creative communities, meaning smaller labels or smaller gatherings of people. The idea of a label less as a label and more as like, I think I've heard people refer to it as LAS, labels as a service.
Oh yeah, I've heard that.
You know? I came across that yesterday. I'd never seen it before. And I was like, fuck, genius. Like, people are making up words to describe new things. It's wonderful.
Well, it's also like the way we operate is kind of fractal, right? Mm-hmm. You see the relationship between artists and labels is changing. And then the labels are seeing how artists are operating, the relationship between labels and distributors or labels or their larger parent companies mm-hmm. or joint venture companies is sort of fractally representing a similar shift as well. Yeah.
I'll give you an example. It's like, you know, I came up in music during the blog era, you know, Pitchfork was like, you know, I came up at a time when you got Best New Music on Pitchfork and it was like, that was it.
Right.
You know, you're popping. What's interesting now is Pitchfork's been sold to Condé Nast. Whatever happens with that organization, that shows a fundamental shift. A lot of people would say the soul is gone from that publication. But what you're seeing is big journalists from that era, like Philip Shelburne, for example, using Substack and then monetizing newsletters. And that, in a way, is becoming the new blog. You know, that's how information is being disseminated. That's interesting. And I think that reflects a lot of what's been happening in music generally.
Yeah, 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 totally, yeah. All right, we have to take a quick break, but when we get back, let's paint a picture of what it would look like if things were done differently. We'll be right back.
Eleanor here with an update from the Music Tectonics Conference. We are so close to selling out super early bird tickets, but you could still snag one if you head to musictectonics.com/conference. $199 is an incredible deal on a 3-day conference packed full of opportunities to meet and do business with innovators, investors, thinkers, and builders of the future of music. Just check out our growing speaker roster, headed by keynoter Mark Mulligan of Midia Research, to get a taste. That super early bird rate expires Tuesday, May 21st, whether those last tickets sell or not. And ticket prices will never be this low again. The 2024 Music Tectonics Conference takes place October 22nd through 24th at Offbeat Venues in Santa Monica, California. Meeting by the beach helps everyone open up to new ideas and relationships, because stuffy convention centers lean to stuffy thinking. Get that super early bird ticket before they fly away at musictectonics.com/conference. See you by the beach.
Okay, we're back, Sammy. This is super interesting because I've never really had this conversation on the podcast, but also I don't think I've had this conversation ever before. So it's all new to me. So it's super fun to explore. Sammy, if you were to craft a new way of funding labels or these creative companies that, you know, were launched by artists or creative people or creators, whatever you want to call it, what would it look like? What would that funding relationship look like?
Let me caveat what I'm about to say by saying two things. A, it's theoretical right now. There are some organizations emerging that are experimenting with new models, one of them being Matt Pincus and his Songs Fund. You know, I'm a big fan of that LVRN deal that he did. Regardless of what that means for that business generally, I think it created a new kind of music company in a lot of ways.
You know, before you go on, explain LVRN, what they do, in case people have heard, as well as what that deal looked like to you from your perspective.
LVRN is a creative company focused on music. They have studios. They have, you know, they work in management and with artists. I think it came out of Atlanta first, but now based in LA, and they've been pretty prominent kind of in the independent scene. You know, they work with like Summer Walker and Black and people like that, artists like that. And what's been interesting is they've been pretty prominent for a while now, and they've been going through kind of the JV model. So, you know, like for a while they had a JV with Interscope, and then they I think they just did a publishing deal with BMG, an admin deal. I don't exactly know the details of that. But then what happened was, out of the blue, Matt Pincus and his his music fund went in and basically invested a chunk of capital in that company based on kind of the valuation model that you would see more in tech, you know, that
I see.
Happens, you know, all the time. And I was really excited about that just because it kind of proved to me that people were thinking about democratizing access to capital. Now, what I mean by that is I've always thought about kind of fundraising, how that works within these creative companies, and how there must be a better way than just doing a JV or a distribution deal. And kind of when I dipped my toes in music tech and, you know, was with our CEO kind of going through the fundraising process, I just had a completely mind-boggling experience because it was difficult. It is annoying to raise money. It doesn't mean that it's not annoying. I just had the experience where we were going through a carousel of like different VCs from all over the United States, maybe even some in Europe. You would sit down, you would give the pitch, they would consider, they'd be like, well, we're a VC X, we have this experience and that experience, and this is what we represent. You know, like hundreds of these companies. And representing like substantial capital, and you could work with one, you could work with many. What are the pros and cons of doing that? What is the plan? But fundamentally, what I saw is we didn't have a product. We were in beta with Baton. I'm talking about Baton. And it's not like we have no cash flow, you know? But we managed to sit down with these people with the help of Bob Moss to basically sell them on the vision and the idea and to give us a substantial amount of money, you know? So in having that experience, I kind of looked at music and I thought, imagine if that was the approach. Imagine that you had the JV and you had the more, let's call them traditional approaches, you know? But imagine as a creative company, you know, led by an artist, let's say for the sake of discussion, who controls how he or she makes the music and controls the direct communication with his community or her community. And they've really worked out something that works, you know? And they get to the point where they're like, okay, what do I need to do? I need scale. You know, imagine when you get to that point, if they could go through the carousel of 150 different VCs who are music VCs, and it's like, well, you know, we're very strong in Japan, VC X, or we have a really close relationship with Sony Music. You know, we have a strategic partnership. We invest money and you get priority service on Orchard or something like that. That's what was really, really lacking. And it's what I saw the first emergence of with the Oliver RN deal. That's why it's a fundamentally new kind of music company, because they raised money, I would say, in the most independent fashion that you can, from one stakeholder who was not a label guy. So they, it means that they're empowered to now and go do whatever kind of distribution deals they want to do, sign talent. Hell, they can go build their own distribution company. You know, they have the funds to do it.
I got you.
It's so interesting.
So what you're saying is, like, traditionally labels would grow with the help of other labels. Typically there'd be a distribution component or a joint venture, and here you have something that the funding is significant but also independent of a label, and feels like because of its significance they have a lot of freedom, because of its independence they have a lot of freedom.
Yeah,
that's what you're saying.
Yes, and additionally that it's incredibly inspiring, because kids now coming up are building these companies. All I mean by companies is a structure around your own project,
right,
in order to kind of like exploit the rights that you own, let's say.
Okay, gotcha.
And kids are looking at that thinking like, I don't need to go and sign to a label now. Before you didn't have to, you could, but the conversation, you'd still have to work with a distributor.
Right.
It's at some way, in some way, shape or form, you always end up becoming a company man or woman. That's just what you had to do in music, you know? Unless you went and built your completely new structure, which, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, like there's very few examples of people doing that.
Right.
I mean, the only example I can think of is Secretly, and that's because, you know, there were like, what, four partners who had four really, you know, very prominent independent labels who decided to join forces and create collectively.
And had the kind of business savvy that, if you're talking about, labels oftentimes need some from somewhere.
Yeah.
And launched their own distribution platform that allowed them to basically leverage the work processes, the relationships that they were already using to add additional revenue coming in as well, as how I understand it. I don't know.
Yeah, no, but already that is enough on a surface level to understand like why that happens so singularly versus like, why isn't everybody doing this? That's always the discussion.
Right.
But I think we've come to a really interesting moment.
So I want to understand, when you were talking about the fundraising you did for Baton, something clicked for you as well. Were you saying that what clicked was that there was a sort of creative distance from the product, in a sense? Like, it didn't feel like they were just looking at the quote, the bottom line, the potential and so forth. But tech companies could kind of raise money without their that creative part that labels have being compromised. Is that what you're saying? Or were you saying it opened your eyes to the idea that if you can raise money for a tech product, you could raise money like a tech product for an artist-based company?
That's the question.
I'm trying to understand what was the moment? Yeah, what was it about that fundraising for Baton that added to your thinking about this potential? You saw the LVRN deal, you did this tech raise. Something about both of those two experiences in your life and observation, I think, is leading you to say, hey, there's another model that's possible.
Okay, so I'll answer that question by taking a step back.
Okay.
And looking at fashion, for example.
Okay.
So I worked with Places and Faces. Cease is an incredible, incredible generational creative. You know, he's built an incredible business for himself. And kind of coming in as a music manager, you have to it's just about striking deals and translating what the artist is attempting to say to potential stakeholders. That's what you're doing at base, and generating assets that you monetize XYZ. And, you know, what was interesting about fashion is fundamentally different business, of course, but you still find the structure of these independent companies led by creatives who in one form or another had created companies that were exploiting assets that they controlled and owned, and monetizing community, basically, by selling t-shirts or by creating parties or, you know, by monetizing a very nuanced sort of cultural capital, let's say. But the problem with fashion, even though it's product, which is different to music, which is not product, you know, it's far more nuanced. Fashion, they faced a very similar issue. It was more developed, but you still had a handful of options for fashion-focused VC companies that you would be able to go and raise money with and hopefully kind of scale your business. The issue that emerged from that was that I think when you look at fashion, you see it homogenized across the board, where a lot of these independent companies end up looking the same or following chasing the same ideas, because structurally they're going to like four or five different funds, essentially, or companies, LVMH being one of them, where you know, those four or five companies aren't competing with other organizations. They have their way that they do this well. So therefore, they apply that way to as many different opportunities as possible, you know? And I thought that was really, really interesting, because like in the same way that the indie label emerged under the major label, that was, you know, more artist focused at the time and more, you know, had closer contact with communities, was better at kind of, was more, yeah, artist friendly. I think that there's a way and there's a space in fashion and in music and in all these businesses that create more nuanced products, let's call them, and assets, to kind of come in and have a gentle touch and be able to kind of like translate what that business could look like at scale, specifically bespoke per opportunity to potential stakeholders. Is this that, because that was kind of the idea that was emerging. And then, you know, to the Baton thing, it's, we actually successfully raised money and I was like, oh, this, I get it now.
Gotcha.
It's the same. You sit down with people, you say, hey, I have an idea.
Got it.
X, this is my background. This is why I can do this. These are the people involved. That's how we're going to achieve it.
Well, what you were just saying before was really clicking for me about the impact this could have on artist and creative-led companies, labels, for example. How do you see these types of music organization operating differently once they have a different approach to funding? You started to hint at it in that last response, but I'm curious if you could flesh that out a little bit more about what will be the result if there was this type of funding that's different than the traditional joint venture or distribution advances, things like that.
I think that we can, to answer this simply, because we can have a four-hour discussion about this specifically, as you know, I will talk a lot about this sort of stuff. But I mean, to answer the question simply, if we go back to the way that creatives, independent creatives, are finding different ways to monetize their content. It's content now. It's music, it's videos, it's live, it's merchandising, all that. I think that understanding that from a music management perspective, understanding that you need to generate all these different fundamentals to make it work, because music won't make a lot of money because the streaming deals aren't great for us, you know? I think that with this idea, if you control your creative company, whether it's a label or you're an artist who controls his or her business, or you even make t-shirts or sell tickets, like whatever that may be, at some point, if you want to achieve a bigger and bigger business, because a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people are quite happy in their jungle, let's say, you're going to have to face the problem of scale, you know? You know, to answer that problem before, you would do a JV on the music side, you would take investment, you XYZ. I think what changes now is the alternative check, as I've been calling it. So it means that you can go and sit down with people who have a specific, but a lot of kind of cross-media, solid business chops, cross-media experience, who can talk, you know, the language of a successful small business that scales. Not infinitely, but like, you know, can scale.
Right.
Who is then able to kind of justify that to potential stakeholders and investors. And not only that, manage that relationship as well, so that you don't have dudes in the boardroom who like have no concept or clue, or haven't been with you for the 5 years it's taken to kind of understand that, you know? And I think what happens at that point is kind of the dream that I've had for a while, which is like being able to build good investment deals using independent money, independent meaning not from one of the major corporations, being able to build not just a capital investment, but a human resources investment, meaning you find the right investor with the right set of skills who is passionate about the company, who can provide something more than just money, because at the end of the day, money is just money. You need mentorship and guidance, you know? And in doing that and in working with someone like me or whoever it might be, that creative is able to kind of achieve that situation, achieve a business plan that long-term will provide scale and a healthy business, but then isn't really, and mentorship, and then and network and resource, and then at the end of the day, isn't changing very much about what they do on a day-to-day basis, because that's the magic, right? These people have arrived at that point by hitting on something very special, in the same way that with tech, the founder has a vision and has created a really special idea. And I think that you don't go and invest in a tech founder to be like, no, you run a business now, you know? Or, I mean, that happens a lot, but like, your business affairs now. You know, you need to go do X. You need to worry about like X, Y, Z.
To define it too specifically,
you want to leave that founder to like continue doing exactly what they're doing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's the same for the creative who has a company.
I think this is clicking for me, Sammy, because, you know, because you've not only managed musical artists, but visual artists have worked with clothing and fashion as well. You're sort of seeing some parallels, but also some differences. But really what I'm thinking, what I think I'm hearing from you about why a different funding model could change things for somebody who started as a creative person in a business is the agility that this opportunity would give them. You're talking about the investor both letting them be the creative person they are, but also giving them access to new verticals or to transmedia or, you know, other sectors to help them translate their artistic vision into a place where the investor already has business relationships, networks, or practices that can help basically translate what they're already doing in other spaces, which is super interesting.
100%. You know, it depends what your driving force is and you know, where you are. But like taking me as an example, I'm agnostic to structure. And what I mean by that is, you know, the difference with music is in music, there's like very set fundamentals that people exploit. It's like catalog and they get lost in this idea. You know, if you look at, for example, what's happening with Hypnosis, you know, Hypnosis sold an idea, whatever. I don't know enough about the inner workings of that business to comment on it. But I think that what we're seeing with the emerging news that's coming out around that is that they kind of sold an idea that catalog was an infinite growth paradigm of value, which maybe they should have thought about a little more, you know? And I'm not talking even about Hypnosis. I'm talking about like all the people that ran kind of the catalog race. And, you know, I think that for people like me and for people who are interested in this idea and democratizing access to fundraising, we're agnostic to structure, you know? A company presents itself and we can look at that opportunity and say, no, this is a music company, but this is also a fashion company. This is a live company. How do we... You know, labels, for example, traditionally are not very good at the live business because they've been so focused on like, how do we make the most amount of money exploiting these music rights? But like, for example, for us being a manager, I've been touring for 10 years. I know how to build touring businesses. I can look at a label and be like, well, it's really interesting. This is a punk label. You release great artists. But like, have we ever thought about building like live IP that the label can own on the live side? It's very easy now to kind of like do deals. It makes sense. It's selling tickets, whether you're selling records or selling tickets. You know, there's not that much of a difference. It just involves experience and like a little bit of confidence and understanding how to build that business and who to work with, you know?
Yeah, cool. Awesome. Well, we have to take one more quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about the other side. Can you get investment for this kind of thing? We'll be right back.
Well, hello, listener. Did you know that this podcast is just one way Music Tectonics goes beneath the surface of music and tech? We know that innovation thrives on community and connection, so we bring innovators together in a variety of ways. We've got a free online event series we call Seismic Activity. We've got the Music Tectonics Conference every October in Los Angeles, and we've got meetups at major industry events like the NAMM Show, South by Southwest, and Music Biz. Stay on top of our schedule. Get the Music Tectonics newsletter in your inbox. Sign up at musictectonics.com.
All right, we're back, and I think I've really started to understand where you're going with this, Sammy. Like, I do think it's really interesting to think about the impact that the joint ventures, the partnerships, and the funding can have on how a creative person who starts a company around music could get limited by that. And you've painted an interesting picture of what's possible, which is super cool to hear about. But I'm curious, on the investment side, do you think investors will go for this?
It's an interesting question. Just because anybody who's raised money for a tech startup knows that it is Gabe, the CEO of Baton, will be the first person to tell you it's soul sucking to do it. You know, there's a lot of cons around that as well. But I think that setting that aside, I think that there are always people in these different communities who kind of are looking soul searching in a way for, on the one hand, a new way of doing things, and on the other hand, philosophically, what it is they are looking to contribute to the wider scene, the world, I guess, you know, to kind of be very dramatic with it. So what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that I think that you will find people that will share that vision on the investor side. And I've met some of them. And additionally to that, it's the job of the bridge, someone like me, I think, who would work with a creative in order to build an actual intelligent investable package from that.
I got you.
You know, cash flow, like what's the plan? You know, we can do that. And it doesn't mean that we have to change anything about the dignity. Dignity might be too much of an intense word, but the soul of that operation. I've worked with artists. I look at what you're doing. We're going to talk about it. You're interested in XYZ. We can build a business from that. We can or we can't. Why? Because it makes money or it doesn't make money. Can it grow? What are we going to do? You know, that's investors at the end of the day care about the bottom line. And it's kind of finding that perfect sort of synergy between vision, legacy, and mission and a good business.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me about a decade ago, there was all this talk about, I think that's what it was, about 360 deals, labels doing 360 mm-hmm, deals. Mm-hmm. And there was it was criticism of it because some people from the artist and management community felt like that was asking for too much. Like, you make this investment and yeah, we were already planning to collect some of that revenue ourselves that wouldn't necessarily be inside the record deal. In a way, you're talking about the artist side as it comes to the investment table to say, this 360 concept is value we bring to the table. And so it changes what the conversation is about who owns that, for example. So it's kind of interesting. It's almost like a decade later response to how record label deals shifted.
I mean, as a manager, I would rarely do a 360 deal. Conceptually, at base, the 360 deal on paper, theoretically, should be great, actually, because we're all coming together and we're investing in your business and blah, blah, blah. We're going to do X, Y, Z. But the problem, again, comes from where is the money coming from? How do the people who are investing the money view the scene? And, like, is there interest in continuing the status quo? You know, so what that means is, like, if you don't get a hit, I'm not interested in this 360 situation that we have, and like you can frankly go over there until you make a hit, you know.
Right.
I mean, I'm butchering it a little bit, but like, you know, I think when you deal with ideas like this, you have to kind of like look at things like super macro, you know, and make general statements.
Yeah. You know, you'll have to get dirty to really sort out how it's going to work out exactly. But yeah, we're talking big picture here. So yeah, we're getting close to the end of our episode here. I'm curious. I've got a couple more questions. How long do you think it'll take to get there? What, you know, like in terms of having this model, I mean, you've already given us at least one example of something kind of like what you're talking about. But is, you know, like when will we see the second one, the third one? When will it start to become of a trend and we'll start to think about labels differently? And what are the challenges to get there as well?
I've been thinking a lot about this because whenever I come to do something new, it always surprises me that not that many people are doing it. Mm. And you don't want to think that like you've come to some like idea. You don't want to think that you've invented the wheel, you know? I think that there's a lot of issues that need to be sorted out for something like this to kind of happen. Let's call it on a mass scale. Like it's something conventional, you know? I think people who come from a VC background still haven't understood the fundamentals of like very specific nuanced music businesses. I think that there's a lot of bad rap that needs to be unlearned that can only be unlearned by experience and by having other people kind of lead from the front. So what I mean by that is like to a VC person, music investments are not good. It's a shitty business to get into, you know, because you're trying to like, I don't know, seed Facebook that makes you like $40 bajillion after like a year's time. You know, they're addicted to this drug of fast, 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 you know?
Yeah.
I think that music is a really hard sell to an investor because it's, you know, A, it doesn't make a ton of, well, it has this, there's this idea attached to it that it doesn't make a ton of money, and B, it's really hard, and C, you know, the fundamentals aren't strong, you know? So I think that like, it's going to take time for the investor types to kind of understand on a nuanced level what working in this business means. You know, they need to do their 10,000 hours. I would love to give you a time frame for that, but I have no idea. Yeah, you know, frankly, what I'm conscious of as well is there aren't a lot of people with this understanding of the different sides of the coin. you know? Right. And that, you know, I think that managers in a way are the only people in music who kind of see all these different sides. And I don't know how long it's going to take for managers have different reasons why they work with artists. You know, I don't know how long it's going to take for them to be like, look at something and be like, well, I can go work with artist X and I can go and like find the money to invest directly in this artist and like manage that relationship. Cause new things are scary, you know? So I think managers also need to see this happen successfully to understand that it is a new and conventional way to do it. And the reason I say successfully is because it's going to take time for these investments to show fruit. That's why, you know, I don't comment. I don't know anything about LVRN's business, and I can't comment on how that investment is going because I don't know anything about it and not enough time has passed.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that it really inspired me conceptually, you know, but I don't know the business fundamentals. I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, does that make sense?
It's totally like, makes sense. Yeah.
Things need to, you know, the flowers have to blossom before anybody's going to be
like. I think the point of this conversation is just there's an idea you've got here that we're putting out there in the world. And I like to talk to people who are in different positions within the music industry, music innovation space, to push my own thinking. But I think we're also pushing the industry and the field forward. You know, as people are listening to you talk about this idea, they'll iterate on it as well. And it might actually make it happen faster.
No, 100%. I think that what we can look at just to kind of like tie this question up, but what I think I can say is this, and I don't want to be like death and gloom, but I think it's important to say. It's important to say right now that the structures don't work. You know, it works for very few people. And that decision-making, true leverage, true decision-making happens at the very, very tippy top, you know, by a handful of people. And, you know, aside from artists having a really hard time, which they are in the new streaming paradigm, or songwriters, you know, we see this constantly in the greater consciousness of music and art, frankly, you know, the middle managers, the managers, the people, the project managers, the people who have to go make this stuff happen, you know, feel like they're drowning. They have there's no purpose really, because it's so very difficult to create these music businesses in a way that, in the current structures, in a way that, like, you know, you have a good chance of succeeding. I think you could say that about everything, but I think that if you look at tech, you know, I don't know the numbers, so I don't want to speak to this, but having experienced working in tech and fundraising myself, it was actually much easier to raise money. This is what it is. It was much easier to raise a large amount of money on a company that hadn't made anything than to get a label to sign an artist who was doing something exciting. Think about that. That's crazy if you think about it, you know? And I don't care what people understand about the fundamentals involved with an artist. Like, that's an issue, you know? It's a sickness, really. I know it's very dramatic, but like, it's the truth. I was talking to a label friend of mine the other day, and both, you know, he runs a seminal independent label in New York. And I picked up the phone and I was like, hi. And he sounded bummed out. I'm like, you good? And he was like, I feel like I'm drowning. And I was like, me too. You know, like, this is really fucking hard. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, cool. This has been really interesting to explore this idea with you, to get your expertise around what is and what could be, Sammy. I've got one last question I frequently ask guests to help us grow our network as we build the Music Tectonics community. If you could help us shout out or identify a few music innovators or music tech companies that you would love to share with our listeners and that we should continue to follow and why you think they're interesting.
There aren't a ton of people doing stuff in this kind of intersection just because it's emerging. But one person that I've looked to and has inspired me a lot without knowing him personally or being involved in any of those deals is Matt Pincus and what he's done with music. I think that he grew up in a VC environment. I think his dad was involved in that sort of stuff. So, you know, he comes from like, and, you know, then went on and founded a very successful publishing company, sold that company to Cobalt. And now has decided to use that expertise to kind of launch a music-specific venture capital fund, essentially. I mean, it's not really venture capital just because, anyway. I think that's really interesting. He did the LVRN deal. He's invested in a bunch of other stuff. I think there's a lot to learn from watching Matt. You know, he's a pioneer in his own way. Another company, a company that is brand new and that I think is really interesting is a company in LA called Dream Street. That the founders, Chad and Brendan, are good friends of mine. they do business with Matt, they do business with a bunch of people, but they're guys who come from, without talking too specifically about their backgrounds, they're guys who come from the venture capital side, left their respective companies and decided to set up a financial advisory firm for music-specific stuff. They do other stuff, but that's kind of like the space because they looked at music and they said, a company like this doesn't exist. Whereas in like tech, you have like 1,000 people you can work with. But you know, their help, what they're doing is they're working with larger companies. They are analyzing potential purchases and mergers. They're making things investable and intelligent in music, which on the fundraising, on the fund side, we have lacked. We've never had something like that.
That's a useful shout out. Appreciate that.
Another company that I really like, just because I like the way they move, is Concord. And I know that that's a larger company. They are theoretically independent, but I really feel that, you know, they kind of went headlong into the catalog game and did really good business doing that. They have a really good approach. And the reason I would watch them is because, you know, they just did a really interesting, it is a JV, but they did a really interesting JV with Pulse and Brent Fires' company, whose name I can't remember. But, you know, they did a JV with Alamo way back. I know that, I don't know the specifics, but on the surface, that seems to be going really well. Concord, I think I'm going to assume are going through a period of soul searching right now, just because the catalog game isn't what everybody thought it was. So, you know, if you have a $1 billion credit line and you have a very specific expertise running a network of labels and you know, that have assets in catalog, like, what are you going to do next? You know, and I think that that's really, really interesting. You know, I think they're really soul searching.
Sammy, this has been great. Thanks so much for coming on to Music Tectonics. It's been a blast taking this deep dive into an area that's new to me and to really get your perspective. I love not only that from a management perspective, you know, you've brought a lot to this conversation, but also not only in music, but also in fashion and in art and so forth too. This has been great. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Music Tectonics. If you like what you hear, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. We have new episodes for you every week. Did you know we do free monthly online events that you, our lovely podcast listeners, can join? Find out more at musictectonics.com. And while you're there, look for the latest about our annual conference and sign up for our newsletter to get updates. Everything we do explores the seismic shifts that shake up music and technology, the way the Earth's tectonic plates cause quakes and make mountains. Connect with Music Tectonics on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. That's my favorite platform. Connect with me, Dimitri Vitsa, if you can spell it. We'll be back again next week, if not sooner.
You're listening to Music Tectonics.